You read a few chapters.
More than a few, I'm saying. And I noticed the word equipoise was used a lot.
Equipoise.
I had to look it up. Just a lot of terms, sentiments.
Terms that were hard to grasp. Your exposure?
I've read it.
The whole thing?
Yep.
Your exposure?
I've heard of it, like, there is a solution. In life, if you're facing any problem, there is a solution in that when you read it completely.
Okay. You've not read it?
No.
But you've heard that it has solutions?
Yeah.
From?
I think it was a quote from Mahatma Gandhi.
Okay. Your exposure?
I've listened to some lectures on YouTube.
YouTube?
Yeah.
Who's speaking?
Some speaker from India. Also from ISKCON.
From ISKCON.
Yeah.
From Bhagavad Gita or Bhagavad Gita as it is?
As it is.
Yeah. Your exposure?
I read it, but very brief. Very little purport. The translations. And now I'm starting reading again, but with Prabhupada's lecture, because it's hard to understand.
Okay. Your exposure?
From here. I've been talking for the past 2 months now.
The last 2 months?
Yes, and I just finally completed the book.
You read the whole book?
Yeah.
Oh.
But
you're not overexposed, I would imagine.
No. Question, what's the difference between Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavad Gita as it is? Because you just mentioned that.
What is the difference?
Between Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavad Gita as it is.
Well, it's a good question. Let me just finish.
Sure.
Get to your exposure.
I don't know if I read the whole thing. I've been reading it, and of course, the purport, and as it is, it's the one I'm reading.
Well, to answer your question, there have been many versions of Bhagavad Gita, translated and published. Many commentaries on Bhagavad Gita. I, for one, had read different versions of Bhagavad Gita when I was in college. I think his name was Isherwood? I can't remember. Yes?
I was saying, I think that sounds familiar.
Yeah.
I have not read that.
Yeah, I read that one. I read a few of them. Not many. I didn't read them for the purpose of enlightenment. I guess curiosity. And I read Bhagavad Gita as it is. It was in 1972. And it was also curiosity. And the difference between, I guess, my exposure to the previous versions of Bhagavad Gita that I had read and the Bhagavad Gita as it is I found that Bhagavad Gita as it is was much more compelling than my previous readings of Bhagavad Gita. I guess in the say compelling that I felt it was relevant, it resonated with my life. It wasn't simply academic. I'm just giving my own subjective experience of the difference between Bhagavad Gita as is and to my exposure to Bhagavad Gita prior to that. And then because of its compelling nature, I felt that it required more investigation, deeper investigation. I guess that was more. Whereas my previous readings of Bhagavad Gita, it was more academic. And there's a reason for that, and I'd explain that, but that would go into I could give a whole 2-hour talk on the difference between Bhagavad Gita as it is and other Bhagavad Gitas. But I'm supposed to give a summary of the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. But I guess one thing I will just add in to that response was that I later discovered the reason why it was more compelling is because unknown to me at the time, I began to gradually learn that the author who gave it as it is, the presentation as it is, presented without giving his own interpretation, but he actually gave the essence of the purpose behind the actual original statements made by Lord Krishna to Arjuna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, which is something we'll get to in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Because when you really study Krishna's purpose for speaking to Arjuna, the purpose was really aimed to be very compelling. It was really aimed to be very enlightening. It was aimed to be not just academic, for something to Arjuna to think about, and then to just think about it, and then go on in his course of action that he was about to take, but to actually to think about it and to act on it. That was the purpose behind Krishna speaking Bhagavad Gita, was to get Arjuna to act, but to act with knowledge. But not by telling him, do this, but by explaining to him why it was beneficial for him to make the right decision. And he gave him a perspective of what the right decision could be, of which Arjuna could actually take action with confidence. And Bhagavad Gita, I believe, if read as it is, then the author should preserve that same purpose as Krishna intended his words given to Arjuna. And that same purpose being preserved, I found by the author, Srila Prabhupada, who there's no other Bhagavad Gita as it is. There are many Bhagavad Gitas, but Srila Prabhupada gave as it is, and I believe that when I read Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita as it is, not only the author was transparent. He gave Krishna. So that Krishna's purpose was no longer a mystery to me, and what his intentions were. Whereas my previous exposure to Bhagavad Gita, I didn't realize it at the time, but Krishna wasn't resonating. I wasn't. And because right in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Matak Pataram Nanyat Kinchidasti Dhananjaya. Krishna says, there's no truth superior to me. It's right there. That's what Krishna says. But you don't get it when you read some other versions of Bhagavad Gita. If there's no truth superior to Krishna, then when Krishna speaks, it should be very compelling for anybody who's looking for the truth. And that's what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to be so. For somebody who's looking for the truth, you should be supposed to realize, wow. Krishna says, there's no truth superior to me. Maybe I should listen to what he has to say. So Krishna comes through. And that's what Srila Prabhupada did, and that's why he called it as it is. Krishna comes through, and Prabhupada didn't in any way try to give his own interpretation. He wanted Krishna to come through. And when he gave, some people may say, well, if he wanted Krishna to come through, then why did he give his commentaries? He wanted to make sure everybody understood what Krishna was saying. And his effectiveness was because he was doing everything that Krishna said to do. And therefore, because he himself was teaching by his own example, not only was it just not only academic, that's because it wasn't an academic presentation, but it was realized because he was speaking from his own realization of accepting Krishna's words in Bhagavad Gita. There it is. So that's the difference. That's the difference. At least, if you were to ask me to tell you that in 1972, after I read Bhagavad Gita, I was clueless. I didn't have the picture as I have now. Was it 47 years later? But back then, what I had was like Well, this is, I'll tell you exactly what happened. I read Bhagavad Gita as it is. I used to read it every night when I came home from work. It took me a little while to complete it. I concluded that this book requires more of a commitment than I'm ready to give. And I put it on the bookshelf and I tried to forget about it. And then my whole perception of reality, unknown to me, changed. And I couldn't, as much as I tried to forget about it, I was seeing things from a completely different perspective about the world, because something about Krishna's words, which came through and resonated, changed my perception of what I observed of this world, and I could see things from a completely different frame of reference. Instead of seeing it from my own frame of reference, I was seeing it from Krishna's frame of reference. And that's what happened. It took time. Who is it? It was a paradigm shift. It was a transition. But I can say that I'm still searching for the full, for the full, complete understanding. And one thing I've realized after 47 years of studying is there's always more to know. So we're going to give a summary of chapter 2 of the Bhagavad Gita. I was supposed to speak on chapter 2 is actually entitled Contents of the Gita Summarized. And as with every summary, everything isn't there. But it's meant to introduce the topics of Bhagavad Gita within the second chapter. There are three primary topics also throughout the Bhagavad Gita, which is Gyan, which is knowledge. Gyan is two types of Gyan. There's Gyan, which is theoretical knowledge, and there's Vigyan. Vigyan, Gyan is theoretical, Vigyan is realized. So I guess you could say, when Krishna speaks and somebody hears with faith and acts upon it, then in the beginning it's Gyan, but by acting upon it, because there's some truth, not some truth, full truth to it, gradually by acting on it, Vigyan manifests, which is one gets some realization. For instance, in the 9th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Raja Vijaya Raja Guyam Pavicham Idam Uttamam Pratyakshavagamam Damyam Shushukam Kartam Avayam. He says, this knowledge is the king of education. It is the most secret of all secrets. And because it gives direct perception of the self by realization, it is the perfection of religion. It is everlasting and is joyfully performed. So Krishna is explaining the difference between Gyan and Vigyan. Because it gives direct perception of the self by realization. It's not just ritual. It's not just academic. This knowledge gives direct perception of the self by realization, which is Vigyan. Realized knowledge. When you act on it. So, one of the topics of the Bhagavad Gita is Gyan, which is knowledge. Another topic is karma. And in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna describes to Arjuna what is called sakama karma and nishkama karma. And we can take some of the verses to explain what is there, what is the difference between sakama karma and nishkama. Kama means actually desires. Sakama means I have some desires I want fulfilled. Nishkama means I have no desires I want fulfilled. I work, but I'm not aspiring for the fruits of my work. Sakama means I'm motivated to work and I want some fruit. So he actually covers Sakama karma and Nishkama karma in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. But he actually wants to bring Arjuna, of course, doesn't want him to stay on the Sakama platform. But he introduces it because it's a reality. Some people are motivated, and because they're motivated by the getting some fruit, and Sakama karma means that one may be motivated by some fruit and may or be made motivated by some reactions that he may get, just like he told Arjuna in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, that it, the consequences of fighting and the consequences of not fighting. If you fight, you'll get a good result. You'll either go to heavenly planets, or if you fight, and you, even if you're killed, you'll go to the heavenly planets. Or if you, and if you win, then you'll enjoy a kingdom in this world. So that was Sakama. And then he gave the consequences of not fighting. If you don't fight, and he said that there'll be consequences. You're a kshatriya. People will look at you and be insulted. They'll insult you because you're supposed to fight. And if you lose the battle, you lose your reputation. If you don't fight, you lose your reputation. And he also describes consequences of not fighting. So this is his presentation of Sakama karma, which is, you know, to motivate Arjuna to fight for the right purpose. But then he gets into Nishkama karma. I'm summarizing. I'll bring the verses in. Then he gets into Nishkama karma. What Nishkama means, okay, I'll work, I'll do my duty, I'm a kshatriya. Kshatriya means I'm a warrior. And of course the whole first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita opens up with, I guess we should probably summarize just a little bit of the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita to get to the reason why Krishna is speaking to Arjuna in the first place, is that Arjuna was standing in the midst of the battlefield. It is a religious battle which is about to take place between the Kauravas and the Pandavas. And the Pandavas were righteous. They were acting on behalf of Lord Krishna, and they wanted to perform their duties as kshatriya to oversee kingdoms, to lead people to righteousness. But yet there was an attempt to usurp the kingdom from the Pandavas, which was their rightful claim by the Kauravas, and who were relatives, but at the same time they were motivated for different purposes. And the Kauravas were intended to usurp the Pandavas' right to their heir, and therefore I'm giving a very, very brief summary. Eventually, it came to the point where the battle had to take place, and the Pandavas were fighting for righteousness, and the Kauravas were representing unrighteousness. And the Pandavas had their armies assembled, the Kauravas had their armies assembled on the other side, and Arjuna, who happened to have as his chariot driver Lord Krishna himself, became the chariot driver for Arjuna. And when Arjuna asked Krishna, please draw my chariot between both armies so I can see who's desirous of fighting. And then he looked on the opposing side, and he saw on the opposing side were his teachers, Dronacharya, who taught him military arts. His family members were on the opposing side. And at that particular point, Arjuna became bewildered And he wanted to renounce his duties. And therefore, he, in that state of consciousness, bewildered consciousness, and because Krishna was right there as his chariot driver, there's a long story if we're going to go explain how is it that Krishna became the chariot driver of Arjuna, but we want to summarize the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. There's a lot to be learned about Krishna's serving Arjuna as his chariot driver. But at one point, Arjuna said, Karpanya doshoho pahatasva bhava, I'm completely confused about my duty. I've lost all composure due to my weakness. In this condition, I'm in my bewildered condition, I'm asking you to please enlighten me, speak to me. Now I'm your disciple. Now I'm surrendered unto you. Please dispel my illusion, dispel my doubts. At that point, Krishna's relationship with Arjuna changed from that as friendly relationships, which is what he was doing in his service as chariot driver, and Krishna took the position of instructing Arjuna, beginning with this second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. And the beginning of his second, as we said, was to explain first jnana, which was knowledge of the difference between the soul and the body. That's preliminary, basic teachings of Bhagavad Gita. That's jnana. It may not be bigyan, it's jnana. We should know what is the difference between the soul. Bigyan, to be realized, and that I'm not this body, it takes time for the bigyan, for the realized knowledge. There are different ways to come to that platform of realization. But if one wants to become fully realized, then one at least has to be enlightened with knowledge. So therefore Krishna was giving Arjuna jnana. He told Arjuna, you are lamenting for what is not worthy of lamentation, what is not worthy of grief. Those who are wise, those who know, lament neither for the living nor for the dead. And then that knowledge began, of course, continued, where he began to describe that for the soul, there's never birth, there's never death, nor having once been, does he ever cease to be. He's unborn, he's undying, he's primeval, he's eternal, he's ever existing, and he is not slain when the body is slain. Okay, this is jnana. He's explaining to Arjuna that you are lamenting for what is not. You are looking at your friends, family. I mean, this is tough. Imagine. I mean, try to imagine. There you are. Not only is it a religious battle, but a kshatriya by code and by religious duty is supposed to fight to death. Either he kills everyone or he dies himself. That's the code. So... It's no question of turning your back. Arjuna was turning his back out of compassion. But his compassion, which Krishna was explaining, his compassion was, as Prabhupada also explains in the purport, compassion for the dress of a drowning man is not very appropriate. If a person's in the ocean drowning and pulls out his dress and says, I've got you. It's not very compassionate. And Arjuna's compassion was drawn on that platform. He was thinking about the body, but he was not thinking about what was the actual soul within the body, and what would the destination of that soul be for having been killed in this battle, which was a religious battle, and what to speak of having been killed, if he gets killed, in Krishna's presence. There is a very astounding, benefit, not only in fighting a religious war, a truly religious war, not something that, like detonating bombs or, suicide vests. We're talking about, we're going into, you know, in the name of religion and killing innocent people. The citizens are not involved. Religious war means the persons who are taking part of the war are warriors who are trained for fighting a battle, and their purpose is to protect religious principles. So, you know, we're not, obviously Krishna is not inciting the fanatical type of religious killings which are going on in modern society, and neither were such events taking place thousands of years ago during this time of when Bhagavad Gita was spoken. But nonetheless, Krishna was trying to make Arjuna understand that you're lamenting for what is not worthy of grief. Do not lament. The soul is eternal. The soul will never die. And your compassion that you're feeling towards your family, of course, is stimulated because you're feeling some connection with family. You're identifying with the body, and you've somehow lost connection with the understanding of the soul. And as we said, for Arjuna, he was feeling compassion. He was thinking, better I retreat, and even if I have to be insulted, than to face these personalities who are even my own, my worshipable superiors on the opposing side. And I, when I know that I have to fight to kill. So that's the perplexing situation for Arjuna, obviously. And therefore Krishna started in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita by giving jnana, by giving knowledge of the soul. They said the soul can be neither moistened by water, nor withered by wind, nor by burnt by fire. The soul cannot in any way be impacted by material interaction of the material action of material elements. Not only that, then he explains that just a very important verse from the second chapter, Dehi no smin yatate he kumaram jovanam tara. As the embodied soul continually passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at the time of death. Those who are dhira, dhirastatra namuyati, those who are dhira, those who are self-realized, they're not bewildered by that change. And Krishna even gives the example, just as a person takes off old clothes, and after taking off and discarding his old clothes, and he puts on new clothes, in the same way the living entity gives up his old previous body, which is destined to die anyways, and he accepts another body. So Krishna is explaining this in the beginning of the second chapter, which is the information which is described as jnana, knowledge of the existence of the soul. And then, as we said, I think those are, maybe, I don't have the Bhagavad Gita memorized in any way, shape, or form. In fact, I haven't even spoken from the second chapter for a long time. Let me look at the verses. There are many other verses. I've only quoted a few of them. Speaking learned words of the, I already quoted this verse, you are the mourning for what is not worthy of grief. Those who are wise lament either for the living or for the dead. Oh, then he says another very important verse. This verse is Natri Vaham Jatun Nasan Natam Nibi Janadipa. He says to Arjuna, it's a very important verse of Bhagavad Gita. He said, never was there a time when I did not exist. Never was there a time when you, Arjuna, did not exist. Never was there a time when all these kings assembled on the battlefield did not exist. Nor in the future will any of us ever cease to be. This is again his knowledge of Gyan, the knowledge he was presenting on Juna about the nature of the eternal soul. But another important point which should be understood from this verse, one who has a proper understanding, at least the way Srila Prabhupada has presented, that the person who's speaking is Krishna, who's a person, Arjuna is his disciple, is a student, and Krishna is the supreme person who is eternal, has no beginning and has no end. So he's saying to Arjuna, never was there a time when I did not exist. He's also saying to Arjuna, never was there a time when you did not exist. Never was there a time when all these kings assembled on the battlefield did not exist. Nor in the future will ever there be a time when they will cease to be, not exist. So Srila Prabhupada explains a very important principle to be understood from this verse of Bhagavad Gita. That for anybody who thinks that a perfected state is to not exist, or to think that liberation means to not exist, Krishna's dispelling that illusion and it's right in the very beginning of Bhagavad Gita, because he's saying, you always existed, and you will always exist in the future. If Krishna wanted to tell Arjuna, we're all one, then why did he go through the exercise of saying, I exist, you exist, the kings exist, and in the future, you will continue to exist? He would have just said, never was there a time when I did not exist. Nor in the future. Because sometimes people have a very foolish misunderstanding of spiritual, what spirit is. Spiritual means they think that in the end, ultimately I merge into the oneness, totality of the oneness. But Krishna is saying, no, you'll always exist individually. Just as you exist individually now in this body, you're different from the other kings, and you're different from me, and you'll always be individually different. That's a hard concept sometimes for people to swallow. Especially, and this is brought out in a later chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, because sometimes people, when they hear that I'm eternal, and I'm individually eternal, and they immediately they draw a conclusion, they mean, I gotta live like this forever. Because they have no sense of understanding what is beyond. They think, I'm paternal, and you mean I'm going to... This is... And for them to hear that sometimes is a very frustrating concept. What to speak of when Krishna says, I'm always existing, but Krishna's God. And I'm always existing as I am, and therefore, if he's always existing and he's God, and I'm always existing... Does that, if I became God after I'm no longer this individual, then why did Krishna make a distinction between me, the kings, and everyone else, and him? No, we're eternally individuals. So who am I individually in relationship to God? The essence of Bhagavad Gita is actually established right from the very beginning. That God is always God, I'm eternal, and what is my relationship with God? Well, if I'm not God, I'll never become God. I never was God. In fact, sometimes people even say, you know, I was God, but somehow I forgot. Sometimes people try to give that argument. And now I have to practice some form of yoga to realize that I'm God. And then Srila Prabhupada will oftentimes say to this, well, if you're God, who's the supreme controller, then how is it possible that some you forgot that you were God? That means something greater than you made you forget. But how could you forget something greater than you that you make you forget that you're God? So these arguments are all dispelled right from the very beginning of Bhagavad Gita with Krishna's statement to Arjuna. You're eternal, I'm eternal. What is the relationship? If anybody with at least a little depth of willingness to try to understand that if Krishna is eternal and he's God, I'm eternal and I'm not God, and we're always existing simultaneously, then what's my connection with him? Anybody who reads Bhagavad Gita should draw a conclusion that I'm a servant of God. And that therefore Krishna describes in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, sakama kama, nishkama kama, and then he speaks about bhakti. He introduces bhakti a little bit because it's the contents of the Gita summarized. And bhakti is, of course, the understanding that is gained by knowing what is my relationship with the Supreme. Bhakti is the yoga of devotion. And that's also summarized later in this chapter of Bhagavad Gita. What time did this start?
6:30.
It started at 6:30. Okay. I can go on. Any questions on anything so far? No questions? You have any questions? You have any questions? No. You're with me?
Yes.
You have any questions?
I want to listen to you more.
You want to listen to me more? Okay. All right, so we were discussing the Jnana part, where Krishna is describing the nature of the soul. And Krishna also says, those who are seers of the truth have concluded that of the non-existent, there is no endurance, and of the eternal soul, there is no change. This they have concluded by studying the nature of both. Then he goes on to explain that which pervades the entire body, you should know it to be indestructible. No one is able to destroy that imperishable soul. Then the material body of the indestructible, immeasurable, and eternal living entity is sure to come to an end. Therefore, fight, O descendant of Bharata. Neither he who thinks the living entity the slayer, nor he who thinks it slain is in knowledge, for the self slays not, nor is slain. The soul is essentially what he's saying. Soul can't be killed. And then he quotes the verse, for the soul is never birth nor death. I already quoted that verse. And then he says, how can a person who knows that the soul is indestructible, eternal, unborn, and immutable, kill anyone or cause anyone to kill? Then he gives the example of a person putting on new garments, giving up the old ones in the same way, changes the body. And then the soul can never be cut to pieces by any weapon, not burned by fire, nor moistened by water, nor withered by wind, unbreakable, insoluble. It can be neither burned nor dried, everlasting, present everywhere, unchangeable, immovable, eternally the same. It is said that the soul is invisible, inconceivable, and immutable. Knowing this, you should not grieve for the body. Then he says, if, however, you think that the soul will always be born and die forever, you still have no reason to lament. For one who has taken his birth is sure to die, and after death one is sure to take birth again. Therefore, in the unavoidable discharge of your duty, you should not lament. Then he says that all created beings are unmanifest in their beginning. These are the same points that I was making before. Unmanifest in the beginning, manifest in their interim state, and unmanifest again when annihilated. So what need is there for lamentation? Unmanifest meaning the body. Body takes its birth, manifest for some time. It's described here, the body goes through constant transformation of birth, growth, duration, production of byproducts, dwindles, vanishes. No longer manifest. Becomes either dust, ashes, or stool. It's no longer manifest. So, that's what he's saying here. Some look at the soul as amazing, some describe him as amazing. Some hear of him as amazing, while others, even after hearing about him, cannot understand him at all. He who dwells in the body can never be slain, therefore you need not grieve for any living being. Then he says, now he's going to speak about this sakama, karma, how he should work. I'm sorry, I have sciatica. And I can't only sit like this for some time. Krishna's words are fully manifesting as the body gets older. Considering your specific duty as a kshatriya, you should know that there is no better engagement for you than fighting on religious principles, and so there is no need for hesitation. Now he's going to give the sakama karma. He said, happy akshatriyas to whom such fighting opportunities come unsought, opening for them the doors of the heavenly planets. If, however, you do not perform this religious duty of fighting, then you will certainly incur sins for neglecting your duties and thus lose your reputation as a fighter. People always speak of your infamy, and for a respectable person, dishonor is worse than death. The great generals who have highly esteemed your name and fame will think that you have left the battlefield out of fear only, and thus they will consider you insignificant. Your enemies will describe you in many unkind words and scorn your ability. What could be more painful for you? He's trying to motivate him. You know? Because he's starting. Actually, when you think about it, because the concept of not being this body, the concept of working always as an instrument for the Supreme in bhakti, the concept of total selflessness, which is a very difficult concept to immediately grasp, how to be totally selfless. And generally, we look out for ourselves. We avoid things that cause distress, and we aspire for things that bring us happiness. And our minds are usually preoccupied throughout the day in this kind of motivation, even though it may be philanthropic by nature, thinking about others. These are described as extended selfishness. They're not completely selfless. So to immediately come to the conclusion, if we want to decide to do the right thing, of come to the conclusion to be totally selfless is not a very easy thing to convince somebody of. So Krishna's taking the same approach with Arjuna. He's taking the same approach to him and saying, okay, I mean, imagine if somebody says to you, if you don't do this, you're going to suffer. Nobody wants to suffer. You're going to suffer because people are going to insult you, they'll have infamy, you're going to incur sinful reactions. Like, there's another story. I'll tell this story because it's not about Arjuna and Krishna, but I like to tell this story. It's about a hunter named Magari. And this hunter named Magari, I'll try to make the story as short as possible, but it's the same principle as there. This hunter named Magari was trained from his childhood by his father to half kill animals. And he used to, although he was a hunter by profession, and by profession it meant that, you know, his duty as a hunter was to kill animals and to use the skins and to use the flesh and for whatever it was that it was required at that time as by a hunter. So, but nonetheless, he would kill them by half-killing them. And he would watch them die, slowly, slow, painful death. And he was quite, by his nature, he was quite preoccupied in slowly killing animals in this way. So there's a story which is explained in Chaitanya Charitamrita, how there was once this great saint, his name is Narada Muni, who happened to come to this place, and he saw in this place there was a deer, a rabbit, and a boar, I believe. And he saw them lying on the path with arrows in them, their bodies flailing, and they were really suffering. And he was trying to understand who was responsible, because obviously somebody fired these arrows into these animals, but usually hunters are quite expert. They know how to shoot and kill. And they know exactly where to shoot and to finish the animal off. But it appeared that these animals were half-killed, so he began to look to the person who was responsible for that, and off in the distance he saw standing behind a tree a hunter with a bow and an arrow. So Narada Muni approached the hunter to inquire from him if he was responsible for this act. And when he approached the hunter, then all the other wild animals that were present at the time, they immediately fled. And the hunter came out from behind the tree, and he was quite disturbed. He said, don't you realize what you just did? I've been wanting, you know, you caused all the other animals to flee. And then Narada Muni said to the hunter, are you responsible for these half-killing these animals? And then the hunter said, yes, my name is Murghari. I'm a hunter. I've been trained from my childhood to half-kill animals. I like it. I enjoy it. I like to see the animals suffering in this way. So that Narada Muni then said to Murghari, he said, you're a hunter by profession. To hunt and to kill animals is a minor offense on your part. But to willfully cause pain to these animals, what that you're doing is very sinful. Because nobody should ever willfully cause pain upon any living being. And he said, do you know that there are terrible consequences for willfully causing pain on another living entity in this way? And it began to describe the laws of karma. And what's going to happen to him is how he's going to have to suffer the reactions, and he explained exactly what happens due to the laws of karma. When you willfully cause pain to other living beings, then you're going to have to get it in the future in some other form, in some other way. And he says, I have one humble request to make of you. And he said, I've come to beg something from you. That's what he said. He said, I've come to beg something from you. And the Murghari said, what would you like? Would you like some animal skins? I have a lot of them. But Narada Muni, being a saintly person, he was thinking exclusively about Murghari and how much he was going to suffer for the pain he was causing. And he says, no. He says, I have one thing I wish to beg from you. He says, it is a minor offense, a slight offense on your part to kill animals as a hunter. That's your profession. He said, but to do all this suffering to the animals, and he explained, you're going to suffer. I come to ask you, please, from now on, just kill the animals. don't cause the pain. So someone may say, here was Magari encouraging him to kill the animals and don't cause them pain, which, and excuse me, this is Narayana Muni encouraging, kill the animals, and then when he described in how much suffering Magari was going to get, Magari became a little bit restless, because he was motivated by the fact that he didn't want to suffer. And because Narada Muni's argument was so compelling, instead of immediately relenting to Narada Muni's suggestion to kill animals and stop half-killing them, he thought, maybe I should ask, how can I become free from the reactions so I don't have to suffer? So that was his mindset at that time. He wasn't ready for, okay, give up hunting, give up causing pain, you know, just chant Hare Krishna, you know, renounce everything. You know, he wasn't ready for that. Narada Muni couldn't understand that. So he said, please just kill the animals, don't half kill them. But because he said how much suffering, then Magari was starting to think, ooh, suffering. And because his arguments were so compelling, he started to think, well, it was not a completely selfless question. He was asking, how do I not suffer? A lot of people think that way, right? You know, how can I enjoy and not suffer? You ever think that way? You know, I wish I could do what I wanted to do and there'd be no consequences. But there's always consequences. Well, how do I avoid those consequences? So Narada was telling Magari, well, yeah, these are the consequences. And Magari was thinking, well, okay, I don't want to have to suffer like that, especially when Narada told him that you'll have to be killed as many times as you kill and cause pain, they'll come back and kill you. It was thought-provoking, to say the least, for Magari. So this is what Krishna is doing with Arjuna. Krishna is telling Arjuna, look, and if you don't fight, and you're a kshatriya, you're going to have to suffer a lot of consequences, sinful reactions for that. Because you're incurring sin. Because you have a duty to fight. And if you don't do your duties, there's reactions to do your duties. And Krishna's going to go on to explain the nature of his doing his duties. But not only said that, but you're going to suffer because everybody's going to look at you, infamy. So, and not only said, but if you do fight, then you'll enjoy. He didn't say you'll go back to the spiritual world. No, he said you'll enjoy it. Because anybody who fights in a religious battlefield, if he's killed, he goes to heavenly kingdom. And if he's not killed and he wins the battle, he enjoys the kingdom. So he was motivating Arjuna, sakama kama, first. Sakama. Either enjoy the kingdom, go to heaven, or suffer. Which you don't, because most people, when they hear about suffering, then they really think, well, in fact, there's a verse in the seventh canto in the Srimad Bhagavatam which says that in the material world, every materialist is endeavoring for happiness and he's trying to avoid distress and therefore he's acting accordingly. So actually, one cannot be happy as long as he endeavors for happiness, because as soon as he begins his endeavors for happiness, he's creating all those conditions for his future distress. This is a 5-year-old boy who made this statement, Prahlad Maharaj. So, but in the material world, everybody's endeavoring for happiness. That's how they think. Yeah, you'll be happy, and if you don't do it, you'll be distressed. So everybody wants happiness, they want to avoid distress. So he started with that. Then he went on and said, Nishkama Kama. And those come in later verses. of the second chapter. I'm going to stop very soon. I'm going to stop just a few minutes, actually. And he said, thus far I have described this knowledge to you through analytical study. Now listen as I explain it in terms of working without fruitive results. O son of Prita, when you act in knowledge, you can free yourself from the bondage of works. So now he's going to say, give another option to Arjuna. You don't have to think of your own happiness. You don't have to think of your own distress. Actually, if you act without the desire of fruitive results, you can come to the platform of what is called Buddhi Yoga. Buddhi Yoga means acting with knowledge. Knowledge means that knowledge of which is our nishkama kama, which is actually means one works, but he's not attached to the results of his work. He works as a matter of duty. Krishna tells Arjuna, you have a right to perform your prescribed duty. You're not entitled to the fruits of your actions. Never consider yourself to be the cause of the results of your activities. Never be attached to not doing your duty. In so many verses, Krishna goes on to explain about working as a matter of duty, not being attached to the results. This is higher. It's higher. In fact, most people who have no understanding whatsoever of devotional service, usually it's, we start with like sakama karma. You don't want to do it. I remember one devotee, his name was Angelo. He later became a disciple of Srila Prabhupada, named Mama Thompson. And it was in 1974. He had come to the temple and I was speaking to him. He told me this many years later. He said, I said to him, we don't know when we're going to die. And I said, death could come at any moment. He said, you don't even know. You may walk out this door. I said to him, I don't remember saying this to him. I said, you may walk out this door and you may just cross the street. I think it was in our old building at North Beacon Street, 1970. I don't think we had moved here yet. And he said, and you'll get hit by a car and you're thinking you're going to live forever, but it could be all over. Mm-hmm. And I said, don't you want to be prepared for that? And when I said that to him, he walked outside and he said every intersection he was crossing. He said, every intersection he crossed, he was always very conscientious to make sure there were no cars coming. And he said he was like that for days. For days, he says he couldn't get out of his mind. You know, it's just. He told me many years later, he said, you know, I have to thank you for telling me, because I lived at that point on for quite some time thinking that death could come at any moment. And was I really ready for it? And as a result, he said, I realized at that point. At some point, he didn't tell me what point it was, he said that I have to do something about this. So, this is what, of course, for Arjuna, he was getting all in one lump sum. But for many people, sometimes it's like, if they're just a little bit thoughtful, they may think, yeah, that. Maybe if you want to be happy, maybe you shouldn't do these things because there's going to be some severe consequences. And a lot of people, actually, believe it or not, a lot of people are, it's usually, in most cases, they actually begin to pursue spiritual understanding with that motivation. With that motivation. I don't want to suffer. Sometimes it may be because they've had a taste of it, and because they've had a taste of it, and they may think, well, if I've only had a taste of it so far, and there's more to come, then maybe I should try to do something to avoid it. So Krishna's doing the same thing with Arjuna. Sakama kama. But then he's saying, presents the picture of Nishkama. It much better is to be in knowledge. And these other verses, from verse 39, Krishna, there's a very, very important point when Krishna makes in this section of the Bhagavad Gita. There's a verse oftentimes quoted by Srila Prabhupada, Neha bhakama nashrishti pachovaya na vijite svapama pyasa dhamasya trahite mahatobaya. That in this endeavor to try to do something in knowledge and to not be attached to the fruits, he says, in this endeavor there's never any loss. There's never any diminution. And even just a little advancement on this path will protect one from the most dangerous type of fear. So he's saying, if you want to jump ahead and try to come to this platform, I'm giving you my assurance. In this endeavor, there will never be any loss. Whatever gain you get in this consciousness, you won't lose. There's never any loss, never any little diminution. And if you get even a little advancement in this path, a little advancement, a little realization, at some point it will protect you from the most dangerous type of fear. This is what he's speaking about. Nishkama, kama, yoga. Which means to work in knowledge. I'm not the doer. Prakriti kriyamana ni gunai kamani savasha. The bewildered soul under the influence of the three modes of material nature. He thinks he's the doer. But in actuality, everything's carried out by the modes of nature, Krishna says. So if he works in that, then he can come to the, on that platform, he can come to the platform of buddhi yoga. Buddhi yoga means to act in knowledge, and it leads to bhakti. So these are all the topics that Krishna summarized in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. They're all elaborated on throughout the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna describes karma, vikarma, ekarma, and where he begins the essence of Bhagavad Gita as in the middle chapters of Bhagavad Gita, where he just begins to describe bhakti and devotion, and then he glorifies the characteristics and qualities of devotional service, and then he tells Arjuna, okay, now I've given you all this information, please deliberate on everything I've told you, and you do as you wish to do. you make your own decisions, because if you want, if bhakti means you have to make your own decisions. You know, Prabhupada used to say, if I put a gun to your head and say, love me, is that love? has to be choice. You have to make your own decisions. So Krishna said the same thing to Arjuna. Now I've given you all this food for thought, deliberate on it, and you do as you wish to do. Arjuna made his choice. That's the contents of the Gita summarized, second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Is that okay? You know? No. Wasn't too lofty. Some questions?
I want to ask about using our intelligence. I feel like sometimes when I have to make a decision, then I tend to use my intelligence and I overanalyze the situation. But sometimes I feel that if I use my intuition, sometimes I can make a good decision with that. So, should we depend too much on intelligence, or should we depend on our intuitive mind, or should we listen to the scriptures, what they're saying? So, good. What combination
good,
should
good
we
question.
Use these resources we have?
Krishna describes in the Bhagavad Gita. I won't give an elaborate answer, but I'll get to the essence of your question. He describes that the senses are like horses. The mind are like reins, which are tied to the horses. Intelligence is like the driver, who holds on to the reins. And the tighter the reins are pulled by the driver, then the more control he has over the senses. because each one of them, the mind is higher than the senses, the intelligence is higher than the mind, and higher than the intelligence is the passenger of the chariot, which is the soul. So, if there's no control of the horses, if the senses are allowed to go wherever they dictate, then it's going to be a pretty bumpy ride for the passenger. And the intelligence is supposed to control the mind, because the mind is a reservoir for all ideas for sense gratification. Very difficult to control the mind. Arjuna told Krishna, "You're telling me to control the mind, but for me, controlling the mind is like trying to control the wind." And Krishna told Arjuna, and he said that for one who's controlled his mind, it's his best friend, but for one who fails to control, it's his worst enemy. And he says, for one who conquers the mind, super soul is reached, and he attains tranquility. For such a man, heat and cold, happiness, distress, honor, dishonor, they're all the same. He transcends duality for conquering the mind. So to conquer the mind, it's not a very easy thing to do with the intelligence. It's not so easy. And therefore, intelligence means how to discriminate between what is right and what is wrong. The mind will say, this looks good, go for it. And the intelligence is supposed to say, hey, wait a minute, are there consequences? Or what will the consequences, oh, good consequences? Bad. Still, duality is still there. Are there good consequences? Or the best duality is still there. Right? Until we actually transcend, we won't be able to transcend duality. But the intelligence is supposed to discriminate between right and wrong, which is in itself is duality. What is right and what is wrong? What is good is what is bad. What is honor? What is dishonor? What is heat? What is cold? What is right? What is wrong? Everything. Duality is there. So, if we want to actually make a decision which is ultimately in our best interest, then we should try to come to the platform of using our intelligence by submitting it to a higher intelligence. Shastra. Scripture. Krishna says in the 14th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, one should know what is his duty and what is not his duty by the rules and regulations which are given in Scripture. He says, one who acts according to his whim and rejects Scripture, he can achieve neither happiness, he can neither perfection, nor can he achieve the supreme destination, Param Gati. Nothing, if he acts according to his own whims. Better to try to find some solid, substantial basis for choosing what is right and what is wrong. We can look for Shastra, or we can look towards somebody who we believe may have a better understanding of the picture than we do. And we can look for them. That's what Arjuna did. Just so happens Arjuna said, okay, I'm throwing everything in. I'm surrendering to you. That was Arjuna's compelling response to his bewilderment. But we may not be ready for that yet, and it takes time to ready. But it begins, but at least by approaching somebody who may have from a higher perspective, a better understanding of what the potential consequences could be from a particular decision that we make. And we try to use our intelligence for pursuing that kind of perspective. So we can either go to a person, or we can go to the Shastra. But intelligence is supposed to discriminate between what is right and wrong, and to control that mind, which has a life of its own, a reservoir of all ideas for sense gratification, and to control it from not making a decision which appears to be so immediately fulfilling and gratifying that we don't see the consequences that could come from that whimsical decision.
Thank you. Just to follow up, so the intuition is also kind of intelligence, which we
intuition?
Should ignore.
Intuition? Intuition is also sometimes as you're getting some help internally between, you know, what is right and what is wrong. But it may not always be right. Yeah. It may not always be right. That's why we stay in the platform of duality. If we, you know, if we really want to be resolute, what is the verse in the Bhagavad Gita? Krishna says, those who are on this path are resolute in purpose and their aim is one. Oh, beloved child of the Kurus, those who are intelligence is irresolute, intelligence is many branched. So if we really want to be resolute, we want to be convinced. Sometimes intuition may give us a little sense of, okay, it's right. But we really want to know that this is what Krishna wants me to do. That's the safest decision. And intuition may not always bring us. But if we've gone through the motions of at least being contemplative enough to consider what the possible consequences are, and not being whimsical, it's a good start to follow intuition. It's a good start.
Thank you.
Because if you just follow, sometimes people call it gut feeling, but gut feeling, I don't know if I want to say that's the same as intuition. Could sometimes be very misleading. Okay, I think it's time for prasad. Yes?
Yeah, we were hoping to break for refreshments around 8:15. We're hoping to squeeze in at least a little more kirtan between now and then, maybe even 5 minutes. Would that be okay?
You're hoping, but what are they hoping for?
What's everyone hoping? Would anyone like more chanting before we go? Before we break for refreshments? I see one head shaking, yes. A few people.
Oh! See?
Or if anybody has to leave, we can.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. It's a weeknight. You know, I'm also trying to be sensitive. Is it a weeknight?
Yeah.
Sometimes I forget what day it is. My spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, said, he said that if anybody who doesn't know what day it is, he's considered to be insane. But a lot of times I don't know what day it is. Guess that doesn't give a very convincing argument of the lecture I just gave. But it's Monday, right?
It is.
Okay.
Yes.
Got it. So tomorrow's Tuesday. And maybe they have other commitments. So maybe you should just move into prasad.
Okay. Alright. So we have khichdi, which is rice, vegetable, and lentil stew. And we also have raspberry bars, which is a dessert. And we have apple cider. So come and get it. Thank you very much to Narayana Swami for coming and leading the kirtan.